Thank you for the invitation to be here. It did come as a surprise because you'll immediately appreciate I'm not a voice or language recognition person, but right from day one I realized that there are lots of issues circulating here that are related to things that we've had to struggle with in connection with DNA evidence. I'm not even a DNA evidence person mainly. I work in a kind of medical genetics context, and my main bread and butter work is, you know, looking for disease genes and causal effects between genes and interesting phenotypes. But I've long had an interest in the interpretation of DNA evidence and tried to contribute a lot to the developments in the field over the years. And I'm pleased to say that we have made a lot of progress. It's also clear that people in this community here have made a lot of progress in trying to get the field on what I would regard as a more rigorous footing in terms of the interpretation, and I'm thinking in a kind of forensic context of evidence that will be comprehensible and meaningful in court. And so I've done a little bit of background reading of interesting work in the field by F and Joachim and several other people here. And so it's clear that I, you know, don't have much to say about the basics. But what I thought I would do is take a sort of slightly contrarian position. And I would say there seems to be a kind of sense I got from the reading that the grass is greener in the next field, that everything is solved and works very well for DNA evidence, and I'm going to tell you that that's not the case. It's very complicated and messy. There are some compromises that sort of work. We are saved to a large extent by the evidence, by the fact that DNA evidence is in general very good evidence and very powerful. And so even if you make a mess of the interpretation, the ultimate outcome might not be the wrong one, but that's not always the case. And actually, the reality in courts today of the presentation of DNA evidence is still pretty dismal, and it does matter. When I get to the end, I'll be talking about the latest generation of low template DNA evidence, where very small amounts of DNA, lots of stochastic effects, and lots of complications. So those of you who are paying careful attention, I've recognized some of what I've read in some of the literature and changed my titles somewhat. Instead of talking, I've talked about comparisons here instead of recognition. So we have the same debate in DNA evidence that you shouldn't talk about DNA identification, because identification is not possible and not the business of the scientific expert. Personally, I'm a bit more lax on that. I'm happy to use words that make sense to the general public, even if we have to be careful about understanding what they really mean. But anyway, in an acknowledgement here, I've put voice comparison in my title. But in the end, although my goal was to try and think about relationships between DNA evidence and voice evidence, all the basic work has already been done by people here, and I didn't feel I had very much to add. So I'm really just going to restrict myself to talking about DNA evidence, some of the problems that we've had, some of my views on how to overcome them, and then we'll leave for the discussion the possibility for people to raise parallels. Nico advised me not to leave any time for discussion because it's a very controversial area, but I'm going to try and take the risk. In fact, I packed quite a lot of stuff into my slides. That sounds to me a bit loud. I'm going to turn it down and just move it down a little bit. I won't have time to get through it all properly, but you have the luxury of knowing that you don't have to really get to grips with all of this material. I just want to give you the kind of flavor of the things, the problems that we worry about. And historical perspective, so I'm going to go back right to the sort of beginning of time, so to speak, of this whole weight of evidence, academic literature. A lot of it springs from this famous case in California in 1968. If I piled up all the papers written about how to interpret the evidence in this case correctly, it would go up to the roof, and it wouldn't reach a conclusion, the famous saying about economists, because it is a very, very interesting case. So I think you get the details just from there, that numbers were made up that might be associated with frequencies for various traits that the defendants possessed, and It was claimed the true criminals also possessed. And, you know, it's lots of fun here. You can give this to students because there's lots of things wrong with this. You know, obviously those probabilities are just made up. Obviously independence is a problem. But there's sort of more fundamental issues. Even if I could wave my magic wand and get rid of those problems, and if those really were true probabilities and they really were independent, what would the number you get by multiplying these probabilities together? What would it mean? And how does it relate to the juror or the finder of facts problem of deciding whether they're guilty? Well, I'm not going to answer that problem for you here entirely, but it's an interesting and difficult problem. But certainly one version to answering it and one branch of the academic literature. So I'm sort of merging things here that slightly, there was developed slightly differently, but the sort of canonical problem for DNA evidence is we've got a sample left at the crime scene. We've already had some discussion of the notion of a match is meaningful for DNA evidence, not always, not for low template DNA evidence with stochastic effects, not for the older form of DNA profiles that was in use in the early 1990s and is still occasionally crops up. But let's just here allow the idea that you know there is a notion of a match, a yes-no answer. And we've got some frequency information. Again, let's not worry about where this frequency information comes from. We'll just believe it for the moment. And so, you know, how convinced should you be? I think the sort of fallacy that many people has already been alluded to here is to think, well, one in a million is pretty small, so he must be guilty. But what, you know, what is the sort of logic there? And there was a bit of an academic literature, a fun discussion that went on for quite a few years. In retrospect, the answer seems fairly easy, and you wonder how we managed to argue about it for quite a number of years. But anyway, that's what academics are there for, and finding problems to argue over. And a consensus eventually emerged around, you know, what from an orthodox Bayesian position would be a kind of standard and straightforward response that you should be using Bayes' theorem, but and I've put one version of it there. You can so introduce some notation. C is the name of the person who committed the crime, or let's say, of course, being the source of the DNA is not logically equivalent to committing the crime, but we'll just suppose it is here. And S is the name of the defendant. And there are some subtleties and difficulties built into here that I'm going to spend a little bit more time talking about, and that revolves around the idea of what is the alternate hypothesis. As I've already mentioned earlier, this idea that I think there's a bit of an impression that the grass is greener in the next field and things are easier for DNA evidence. But one of the things that's not easier in some is this specifying of the alternate hypothesis, and it can be quite a difficulty logically in a number of ways. But here I'm going to assume so in the speech recognition literature, people have been happy to just posit that the null hypothesis, the prosecution hypothesis, if you like, is same source, that the queried voice and the suspect's voice come from the same individual, or different source. For DNA evidence, at least, it can't be that simple, and I've chosen to break down the alternate hypothesis here into a number of hypotheses of the form X did it for various X. But for more complex problems, there are different ways to break down the evidence, the alternative hypotheses. For example, if there are multiple DNA samples, which is often the case, there are lots of alternatives around different contributors to the different samples. You know, just often it's just assumed implicitly that there's a single contributor, but for mixed samples, that's not at all straightforward. There's different alternate hypotheses around relatedness, and there's different alternative hypotheses around the number of contributors to the sample. In this form here, I'm just thinking about breaking down the alternate hypotheses into all the individuals who it could have been, and we have to add up over these evidence. Logically, you have to add up over everyone on Earth, this idea came up actually in a court case, and the judge was horrified at the idea that he has to sit there and think about every person on Earth one at a time. But I want to emphasize this point that logically you have to. If you want to prove that a particular individual is the source of your DNA or the source of your voice recording, logically that means that everyone else on Earth is not the source, and also alternate hypotheses around synthetic voice fabrication and these kind of things, all of those hypotheses have to be ruled out in order to establish the one hypothesis that you care about. So a little bit of manipulation. We can write our formula like this. Again, this is kind of just a kind of classic way of breaking down the evidence, breaking down the calculation in Bayes' theorem. And I just introduce some notation here. I put R for the likelihood ratio. And again, I want to emphasize there isn't one likelihood ratio. There are many, and we can't duck this difficult problem of how to combine the likelihood ratios, although we'd like to. I'm thinking in terms of the DNA evidence being interpreted last, and so this other ratio, the prior, I'm thinking of as incorporating all the other evidence. I mean, there's no logical reason for doing it that way around, of course. That's for the sort of nice coherence property of the Bayesian analysis, that you don't have to, you get the same answer whichever order you analyze the evidence. And in order to get it in this form, you need to make independence assumptions that we could argue about but seem generally reasonable here. So putting getting to be able to write weight of evidence in this form in a kind of forensic setting was a pretty big step forward. It took many years and lots of argument and so on, but it's pretty much accepted amongst a big community nowadays, and it overcame a lot of problems that people struggled with. I mean, I've been in the field so long now that it's sort of hard to remember how difficult some of these struggles were. But this basic idea that I mentioned to you, that, well, one in a million is really small, he must be guilty, it's not true, and people didn't know how to think about that until we were able to formalize the problem in this way. And now it seems pretty easy to think about it, for, again, this is a simplification, and the general problem is not that simple, but one way to think about it is how many alternate suspects there are, under some simplifying assumptions, you essentially add up the likelihood ratio over your alternate suspects. And so a likelihood ratio of 1 over a million isn't convincing if the number of alternate suspects is large. I've already hinted at the time that there's a fundamental logical problem here about this distinction between the role of the experts and the role of the finder of fact. I'll come back to that, but this is certainly only true under some simplifying assumptions, and whenever, if I kind of present this idea in court, I have to sort of be careful about wording, like, if you choose to assume that all the alternate suspects are equally likely, then you come up with a formula like this. Of course, nowadays, the likelihood ratios are much bigger or smaller, whichever way you do them around, than 1 million, in typical cases, the problem has vanished. But again, I want to emphasize there's lots of cases out there with mixed profiles, small amounts of DNA, complex relatedness, where all of these issues still matter. The role of relatives. So there was, much confusion about this in the past. This nice formalization in terms of Bayes' theorem. I might slip into this language, but another point for discussion is I don't think of what I'm doing is fundamentally Bayesian. I tend to avoid the label Bayesian. I'm just using Bayes' theorem, and it's a theorem of probability that all adherents to mathematical probability accept. In fact, I would say my approach is fundamentally non-Bayesian in ways that I will point out later. I just remembered now, I forgot to put a slide on this. There was a mention of it. There was a big court case in the UK a number of years ago where there was strong DNA evidence implicating a defendant, but there was quite a substantial amount of evidence in his favour, and in particular, the victim of this crime gave a good description of the defendant, of the attacker, and the defendant didn't match, you know, gross mismatch between the description and what he looked like. But she also said in court, this does not resemble the man that attacked, you know, he does not resemble the man that attacked me. She didn't say it wasn't him. She said it doesn't resemble the man that attacked me. And so, and he had an alibi and wasn't near the scene of the crime at the time. And so, quite a complicated case, went to some retrials, and I wasn't involved in that case, but the defense expert actually proposed to talk the jurors through a Bayes' theorem calculation with likelihood ratios for the witness description and likelihood ratios for the DNA evidence and likelihood ratios for the alibi evidence, and suggesting values, and the jurors were asked to multiply them together. And the judge got quite enthusiastic about this and ordered somebody to go out and buy a dozen calculators for the jurors to multiply the numbers together, but the judge kept getting zero and when he tried to do the calculation himself. Anyway, the guy was convicted, but it went to appeal, and the appeal court was sort of horrified, absolutely horrified about this complicated mathematical stuff that these wise old judges didn't understand. Was about having this in court, and so the judgment was very severe that Bayesian methods were not to be introduced in UK courts, that because us grey-haired old judges don't understand it, and it's all a sort of power thing. They were worried about losing their power. But I just thought it was a sort of amusing idea that any form of reasoning is allowed. There is no other rule, as far as I know. There's no all reasoning is allowed in a British court except the form of reasoning that's been established to sort of be logical and rational and reasonable. That's the only thing you're not allowed to present in a British court. So that's that was a bit of an aside, but that's why I sort of avoid the label Bayesian, and I think it is irrelevant and to what we are doing. And of course, I don't ever explicitly introduce mathematical formalism whenever I'm giving expert witness, but I do try and talk the jurors through this kind of thing and say, imagine how many close relatives there are of the defendant, what is the match probability for them, and imagine how many unrelated people, what's the match probability, and you've got to combine that total weight to come up with a... And if that combined weight is non-negligible, then you've got reasonable doubt about having the right guy, unless there's other evidence implicating those or not implicating the brothers and so forth. Whoops, what's happened here? Here's many of these features, of course, that I'm going to be talking to you aren't really relevant to voice recognition, but I think some of them will be. I've got ethnic in the label here, and I only mean genetic ideas of ethnicity here. Relatedness matters for DNA evidence, and this is really the same issue as close relatives, but it's just relatedness on a more distant scale. So the relatedness of people in an isolated geographical or religious group and so on. Compared to relatives, their relatedness is less, relatives like cousins and so forth, their relatedness is less, but there's typically more of them, and so they kind of plausibly balance out. I'll come back to all of this. Really, really important to these issues are around, and a real fundamental difficulty that I don't think we really have solved is what to do about lab error, labeling errors, and outright evidence fraud. But at least the Bayes' theorem paradigm tells us how to think about the problem and what the relevant issues are. But what it tells us is a little bit worrying. I mean, first of all, one thing that's not worrying is that some critics of DNA evidence were going around saying, well, no human activity has an error rate less than about 1 in 1,000, and therefore numbers like 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8 that come up in connection with DNA evidence are completely meaningless. So that reasoning is invalid, because it's not the probability of any error that matters, but only an error that generated the data that we observed. And so there's a famous story that Phil David pointed me to from Price. I think he's probably 18th century English philosopher who discussed this point, that a printing error in the newspaper is more likely than you winning the lottery. But nevertheless, if you see your number printed in the newspaper as the winning lottery number, you don't throw the newspaper out and say, ah, probably a printing error, because it's not any printing error that matters. The printing error that generated your number is much less likely than you winning the lottery, and therefore you do throw the paper up and run down to the lottery office to claim your prize. But this is a fundamentally problem that some of the more reasoned critics of DNA evidence, I don't think we can easily get away with this, that evidence tampering doesn't involve this problem, because evidence tampering does generate the evidence observed. And typically, a reasonable person's view of the probability that the police or somebody else have tampered with the evidence in some way is going to be much greater than a match probability or likelihood ratio in connection with DNA evidence. And logically, I think it is true that because of this, this typically will swamp the significance of the match probability for DNA evidence, so that if you do get a good DNA profile match, the actual number connected with it is pretty meaningless. It's virtually impossible, and we're down now to thinking about these kind of alternatives. But what an expert can do about that in court is quite difficult. You can't even consider putting numbers on this kind of thing, of course. Ideally, you should be alerting jurors to this possibility, that it should be, you know, weighed in combination with the match probability for the DNA evidence. And I don't have time to go over this here. This is all sort of historical stuff, but this was a sort of fun debate. Well, not fun really, because it did get a bit tedious. It just went on and on and on, and it still goes on, this argument about the effect of the evidence. I know some of you have read some of this literature, so you'll be aware of these issues, but perhaps some of you won't be. Imagine case number one. I just say, you know, he matches, and it's 1 in 1,000,000 probability of a match. Case number two, I tell you those two facts, but I also tell you, oh, by the way, I found him by looking through our database of DNA profiles, and he was the only match. Now, in which case is the evidence stronger, case one or case two? The classical statistical viewpoint is, case two is evidence trawling. You've gone through the, you've gone out fishing for hypotheses, and we all know about multiple testing and Bonferroni corrections and this kind of thing. Evidence is much weaker if you go fishing for hypotheses. If the defendant has been identified through a search in a database of an intelligence database of known previous offenders, the data are weaker than in a standard case. And of course, that's completely wrong. I think the standard statistical reasoning is just inappropriate here. Certainly, all of that, you know, there's a classical argument about frequentist and Bayesian views in the literature, but often the frequentist and the Bayesians get to roughly the same place in the end. But here's one example where they get to very different places. And because of the strong logical foundations of the Bayesian foundation, whenever the two of them disagree, it's pretty much always the Bayesian view that's right. And it is here what people who are worried about the evidence trawling idea and that weakening the evidence, the problem with their approach is they are not being critical enough in the first case, because even if there was no evidence trawling, even if there was no database search, I still have to logically, to prove that this guy committed the crime, I have to prove that every other person on earth didn't commit the crime. Those two formulations are equivalent statements of the problem. That's a really tough task, and nobody else Nobody would have dared to even contemplate that in the past because it was unthinkable that you could prove that everyone else on Earth didn't do it. But you can now with DNA evidence. You can think about it and arguably do. And so any amount of fishing or trawling for hypotheses, it doesn't change that fact that you still have to prove that everyone else on Earth didn't commit the crime. And in fact, it makes life better because everyone else in the database didn't match. So that helps you in your task of proving that everyone else on Earth didn't commit the crime, because you've got a whole lot of people that you've shown not to, that their profile doesn't match. That latter argument is an argument about hypotheses rather than, so this issue about probabilities of evidence versus probabilities of hypotheses, I'm going to say a bit more about that in a moment. We like to separate the two, but I insist that fundamentally it's not possible to achieve that ideal in many situations. That's not really important here. So there are some of the things where I feel that the formulation of the problem, even though it's just a sort of standard version of Bayes' theorem, it wasn't obvious for about 20 or 30 years after the Collins case, when all this academic literature was piling up. People didn't get to this position of just writing down Bayes' theorem and seeing its implications in the way I'm describing them. Nowadays, the majority of people, even in the field, don't succeed in understanding the evidence this way, but there's a big enough community of us that do, that isn't a problem. But there are many, many problems that remain, and I've already sort of stressed this one, but this is one of my key points about the difficulty is that, you know, it's nice to think about a competition between the prosecution hypothesis and the defense hypothesis, and you know, many lawyers have argued with me that this fundamentally is what the whole legal system is based on, a competition between two hypotheses, and they sort of reject my idea that I've represented there, but I claim that this is just a straightforward logical situation, that in order to establish hypothesis one, the prosecution hypothesis, you must prove that every other competing hypothesis is false, whether or not the defense puts it forward. And of course, in most legal systems, the defense don't have to put forward any story at all, of course. And even if they do put forward a story, judges usually advise the court the jurors in our setting that they don't necessarily, even if they disbelieve the defense story, it doesn't necessarily mean that the defendant is guilty. These are separate questions and have to be answered separately. It's inevitable that the forensic scientist has to make subjective judgments about, for example, implausible hypotheses. So in DNA evidence, you've always got the "it was my identical twin" story, which makes DNA evidence completely useless. It's actually quite remarkable how rarely that is used. I think that everyone would just laugh it out of court, but actually identical twins are not that rare, and it's very hard to prove that you don't have an identical twin. So if any of you do commit a serious crime and are up on court with DNA evidence, I do recommend you try this story. I think logically it's hard to beat, but nevertheless in practice I think you won't succeed, unfortunately. But also in DNA evidence, we have the number of contributors to a DNA sample. Even if there's no more than two alleles at every locus, it doesn't follow that there's only one contributor. There's no upper bound on the number of contributors. I'm right in the middle of a court case in Oxford. I was giving evidence on Friday and have to go back and continue my evidence tomorrow. It looks like one contributor to the crime sample, and I did some calculations for one contributor and for two contributors, and of course that I'm advising the prosecution in this case. Usually I'm advising the defense, but the defense of course has jumped up and said, "You haven't done any calculations for three contributors." And of course I said, "Well, you know, there's no sign of even two contributors, so three contributors is ridiculous." And they say, "Ah, but you cannot rule out the possibility of three contributors," and I have to concede that I can't. You know, that's a subjective judgment that I've made. It kind of transgresses this idea of trying to keep a clear logical distinction between the likelihood ratio and the probabilities of hypotheses. I don't know if you can read this. In this respect, sin is completely unavoidable. That you can't avoid making judgments about probabilities of hypotheses. But nevertheless, we should maintain the goal of righteous behavior, which is to try and avoid as far as possible any assumptions about hypotheses and, you know, to be aware of them and make them explicit as far as we can. I didn't mention this one as well. Contamination rates are also an issue here. There is, sometimes it's easy to get confused with discussions of priors, because there is a prior on the hypothesis that he's guilty, for example, and that's very clearly not the business of the expert and is the matter of the finder of fact. And it's very, you know, we have to be very careful in our wording to avoid any suggestion that we're expressing a view on the probability that he's guilty, either before or after the evidence. But of course we include priors for other quantities all the way along, and particularly the rate of contamination. So with low template DNA profiles, it's just amazing how difficult it is to get rid of contamination. Our environment is entirely covered with DNA. You know, for meters around me, there is my DNA spattered everywhere from my breath. And you know, touching things leaves your DNA. It's a very kind of shocking thought when you think about, you know, hey, this room is entirely covered with DNA. A very thin film, obviously. And we cannot ever exclude that some of the alleles we see in a mixed profile have got there not through any of the main contributors that we're thinking about as the offenders to the crime, but some environmental contamination. That's a really serious issue with low template DNA profiles, but in any case, any assessment about the contamination rate is effectively a prior judgment based on, you know, various factors of that I've hinted at there. Okay, as I warned, I've got too much stuff here. I won't say very much. I haven't said anything really about the technology of DNA profiling. There's a little bit there for those of you who don't know. It's just that these short tandem repeat profiles are little words of DNA that are repeated a number of times, and the number of repeats affects the length. In the current technology, it's still not sequence-based, even though this may change in the future, but there's so much investment in this technology now that it's hard to think about changing it. We don't actually read the sequence, we just measure the length of a DNA fragment, and the length is measured by running these fragments through a gel, and there's a laser detector at the finish line, and time taken corresponds to the length of the fragment. Usually, we can interpolate the number of repeats. So you might have 7 copies of the repeat on one chromosome and 9 on the other. So your genotype would be represented as 7-9. But unfortunately for this nice story, partial repeats do occur. This doesn't mean 9.3, the decimal number. It means 9 copies of the 4 base pair repeat and then a 3 base pair fragment repeat. Nevertheless, it is pretty much possible to say yes, no, whether the fragment lengths match. And this is a sort of idealized view of the electropherogram. This is basically a time series plot as these fragments pass the finish line. There are dyes, you know, colored dyes you can think about that distinguish the fragments from different loci, and then different loci have fragments in a different length ranges, so that enables you in one test tube to analyze 10 or 20 genetic loci. And in the current technology, we'd love to be able to take into account the heights of these peaks, but we don't. We just do a sort of binary yes-no, there is a peak here. And I'll come back to that in a little bit if I have time, because with small amounts of DNA, that becomes problematic. So there's lots of problems with these issues of where do the probabilities come from? People have mentioned to me here, and it's sort of true that in DNA, it's easy because we've got population genetics theory, which generates probabilities, and of course, you know, largely the population genetics theory is based on one of Bruno's famous sons, of course, Mendel, who is here and who did his work on the peas here. But nevertheless, although Mendel's laws as applied here are near enough to being objective facts, There's lots of elements of the theory that's subjective. Strength of DNA evidence is all about relatedness, and these questions of independence are all questions about relatedness. And how you model relatedness is, you know, a typical story in complex scientific evidence. If you think about it, all the people in this room, we've got hugely complicated patterns of relatedness through all, think of all my lineages, mother, father, four grandparents, eight grandparents, you know, go back five generations where we're up to large numbers of ancestors, and then any other individual in this room has got, you know, so many lineages, up to 16 great-grandparents, and every pair of those lineages, one of my 16 great-grandparents and one of your 16 great-grandparents, all meet in a common ancestor at some point in the past, and unless you think I'm an alien from another planet, but more or less there's pretty substantial evidence that we all have common ancestors. So a fully detailed model would specify all the patterns of relatedness for every individual on Earth, and of course that's ridiculously complicated, so we have to make simplifying assumptions, and most of the models kind of break relatedness down into three levels: known relatedness, which is usually, you know, just one or two generations in the past, relatedness due to unknown shared ancestors but understood to be on a relatively recent timescale, and how you define recent is how these theories vary, and then the completely unrelated case is an idealized case where the ancestors are so far back that it really doesn't matter and we can just assume independence. They are kind of good enough models, even too few people really understand how they work now, but you know, they're a great simplification on reality, and I just want to emphasize the subjectiveness of the underlying all of these models. There's a lot of argument over the years about independence, various independence assumptions that go together, and that's of course important for you guys as well. This is where we do have an advantage that the only dependence that matters is due to relatedness. The other important point I want to make, of course, is that whether or not two things, you know, it's a kind of meaningless thing to say A is independent of B in a kind of for general real world objects there. Independence is all about what information you condition on, and if you get the conditioning right, things are typically independent to a good enough approximation. The example I've used is reading ability and shoe size in children are not independent. The better readers have bigger feet, and that's a very well-established fact, and you can look at the correlation, it's quite strong. Of course, they're dependent because of the varying ages. Both of those things are correlated with age. If you condition on age, the dependence goes away. Similarly, if you do the right conditioning for DNA evidence, you can make a reasonable assumption of independence, although, of course, you know, if you want to take a contrarian position, which of course defenses in courts sometimes do, you can never, you know, rigorously prove anything to be independent. What matters fundamentally in the match probability is a statement like this at a single locus: the probability that an unknown individual X has genotype AB, given the data that the suspect, yes, or defendant has genotype AB. I just lost the plug. What have I lost here? Okay, good. I can just put this back. What matters is affected by this conditioning, and of course the probability that this guy's got AB, given that this guy's got AB, depends on their relatedness. What doesn't matter, and has been argued about at great length, is the dependence or otherwise of the two alleles within a locus, the so-called Hardy-Weinberg equilibrium. Much discussion about this. It's relatively unimportant. I've perhaps overemphasized in my writing this conditioning because that's what I see as the important one. But of course, there's a lot of other stuff in the conditioning as well. There's all kinds of assumptions and background data that you are relying on, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. Now, I see I'm going to take, though I didn't intend to, follow Nico's advice and use up all my time and not leave any for discussion. But there's a big, this is where I say that what I've been doing is fundamentally non-Bayesian, although based on Bayes' theorem, because all of these theories require parameter estimates, and everybody likes to put in plug-in estimates, It's the simplest thing to do, but also, you know, you can think about what the different estimates are, the different parameter estimates are, and change them. So the parameters for us are the allele frequencies and this population genetics parameter, which is the average relatedness in a community. We've got various estimates of these. We like to use plug-in estimates. It has an advantage that it keeps the evidence specific to the case over here and all your training and background data that feed into your plug-in estimates over there. Of course, the ideal and, again, the sort of Bayesian position would be to integrate out the unknowns and to, in a sense, combine the data. So, Phil David in London wrote some papers trying to do this, where the data you condition on is not just the defendant's profile, but the defendant's profile and all the profiles you've ever seen before that form your background information. So, while recognizing this ideal, I just think it is just a bit too complicated, and so I have done a sort of awkward compromise of using plug-in estimates, but in recognition of these problems, the expectation of a high power can be much greater than the power of the expectation. So this is why putting in plug-in estimates that are something like maximum likelihood estimates can be really, really misleading, because the effect of uncertainty is not symmetric when you've got high powers and products. There's a sort of vast amount of wasted literature in this field, like there is in any academic field. So you have people talking about how to do maximum likelihood estimates of these plug-in parameters, and it's just a complete waste of time, because the maximum likelihood estimate, or anything like it, any kind of sensible estimate in the middle of the distribution, is hopelessly wrong because of this problem here. But I haven't really got a very good solution. I just say, well, we want something near the top of the plausible range, like a 90th or 95th percentile or something like that. Although, of course, I haven't really got any formal justification for doing that. Right, a lot more to say. What should I choose to include? I can't resist talking a little bit. I've talked about the probabilities coming from theories, population genetics theories, which sound very grand, and I can easily put them past a courtroom who never sort of questioned me about any of these things. But ultimately, when you're looking at them, it's all full of subjectivity and judgments, and I've chosen this theory and not that theory, and so on. Of course, many people are unhappy with that kind of subjective element, and they want a sort of rigorous, and one way, and again, a sort of classical statistical position to get a kind of rigorous probabilities is to put it in the context of random sampling. So there's a lot of literature out there and a lot of uncritical thinking which is based around the idea that the suspect has been chosen randomly in a population. Now, I've already talked about evidence tampering and the relatively high probability that the police could have fiddled with the evidence, but the possibility that the police are capable of uniform random sampling is completely ridiculous. I don't accuse them of that, of course. All the experts in the world can't do, find it very difficult to do uniform random sampling. And so, many people think that the uniform random sampling idea puts the field on a rigorous footing because these are objective probabilities. And I would say, yes, they're objective, but it's clearly nonsense. The police haven't sampled suspects randomly. This is just a completely made-up assumption, which is... I'm probably overdoing it here. I mean, it is the kind of assumption that people make, and for good reason in some settings, but I don't think we need to make it here. And it does lead to lots of problems, and in particular, the sort of endless arguments about in which population has the suspect been randomly chosen. And I say here that, because there is no such sampling and there is no such population, it's like arguing over the number of wings on the tooth fairy, that there is no such object, so there's no point arguing about its properties. But there is a real fundamental problem here, that the more narrowly you define the population, the better it is for the defendant. And we usually try to sort of lean in the defendant's direction, but the only logical endpoint of this is a population of size 1 that includes the defendant and has 100% frequency for the defendant's profile, which of course is a useless position. And of course you lose all these nice advantages of the Bayesian formulation, because this random sampling hypothesis, I don't know, I suppose you could do it. I mean, you just can't do it in a Bayesian way because it's just a ridiculous hypothesis that's got nothing to do with the evidence. And all of this stuff which works well in the framework I've been telling you about is hard to do in this setting. Right, this is an old topic of mine, and I will skip over this one, that the U.S. National Research Council did a report nearly 15 years ago. It still holds absolute sway in the U.S. It's all based on this random man hypothesis, and it's all kind of riddled with errors, but it's interesting in the sort of psychology of a field. We had huge arguments about DNA evidence in the early 1990s, and in 1996, the mood was just right to kind of settle on a compromise, and so the authority of the National Research Council in the U.S. was such that everyone kind of leapt on this, and in some kind of practical sense, it sort of worked. You know, DNA evidence based on this has convicted a lot of people in the U.S., and they're probably all guilty, but the fact that it's completely riddled with misunderstandings and errors and the evidence has been overstated in almost every court case in the U.S. involving DNA evidence. The evidence is routinely overstated because of this. But, you know, the truth is that the evidence was probably pretty strong anyway, and this is why we haven't had the kind of gross miscarriages of justice coming to light that would have shown up these flaws. So I won't go into that, but all of these things I've been talking about, they misunderstood. But really, the important thing was this population genetics, where what we care about is a conditional match probability, but what they cared about was just the marginal probability. And everything, all the population genetics issues are in this conditioning. And so by leaving that out, they had all population genetics experts on this committee, and they had big chapters on population genetics and completely missed the point and gave completely misleading recommendations. Now, I warned you that I tried to have too much material in this talk, and I've whizzed through all these topics, but I just want to bring you up to date with some of the... because everything I've been talking about to date, I could have talked about years ago. It's sort of, they were the arguments of the 90s and the early 2000s. But what's really come to a crunch this year in particular is what to do about this low template DNA. We're down to getting DNA from samples of just two or three cells, and so there's huge stochasticity in the results. And of course many jurisdictions just say this is way too complicated and we don't want to touch this, but more and more, particularly in the UK, but more and more people are being tempted in, and it is potentially, you know, it does mean that just from the slightest touch, it's rather than collect a fingerprint, it's can be strong evidence to collect DNA from the sweat that formed the fingerprint. But we get all these kind of stochastic features. I've got some slides here. I won't have time to. But these peaks that I showed you about, you get... So the top half is with good DNA, good amount of DNA, and this is with sort of moderately low amount of DNA, and you get all these features like peak imbalance, but most worryingly, complete dropout of an allele. See, there are two peaks there, but there's only one showed up here, and that's because the PCR reaction that underlies the whole thing with so few cells involved, it can just completely fail if there's some mutation in the primer or something else goes wrong. And you can get drop-in of contaminatory alleles. You would have thought that these high-tech laboratories could keep their lab DNA free, but it's absolutely impossible. Even just, you know, the plasticware that people use, it's full of DNA, and you just, because our DNA is everywhere in our environment, it's impossible to keep it out entirely. So there's a little bit here about the various so these thresholds that are being used. You can see that the way the evidence is analyzed is quite crude. But this threshold means anything below this doesn't count. So this peak here is very strong evidence, could be against an individual, but that peak is no evidence at all because it's because of the thresholding effect. But this is the threshold for where if there's a single peak above this, we assume there's enough DNA at that locus that its partner hasn't dropped out. And if there's only one allele, it's a true homozygote. But a single peak below this, such as that one there, the black one, it doesn't have a partner, but because it's below the threshold, it's considered the dropout. All of this is sort of arbitrary and very unsatisfactory, but it's about the best we're at the moment. I won't say so much about that case now, because I'm running out of time, but this is a zoom in on what the electropherograms actually look like, and with these low amounts of DNA, it's quite noisy. This 13 allele turned out to be quite important, and at the time of this court case, 50 on this axis was regarded as the threshold, and you can see the allele 13 reached a peak height of 54 on this one run after dozens and dozens of reruns of different samples from the crime scene. That was the only time that it reached above 50, but that counted as a full allele, and this, because it's a rare allele, turned out to be the strongest evidence against this guy. So you can see why this peak here, much bigger than that one, is of no evidential value. That's just an experimental artifact called stutter. This one here and this one here are assumed to be just background noise, and so you can see that it's sort of quite a sensitive issue about whether that's a real peak, but nevertheless it was counted as such. And in that case, there were some three alleles that should have been there if the defendant really was the contributor to the sample, but weren't, and we had a lot of argument about how to deal with this. And the standard way of analyzing this problem is a kind of version of the random man thing. You work out the probability that a guy chosen at random in the population would be excluded by this evidence. And there's a huge amount of problems with this. You probably gather that I'm not a fan at all of this approach. And I've got a whole list of here of things that are wrong, but I'm sort of rushing now at the end of my talk. So I won't go in any detail, but other than to say that in the whole idea of inclusion and exclusion don't apply anymore when we've got small amounts of DNA. And that's just one of many problems with this approach. And I was going to talk you through a little bit of the how to work through a likelihood ratio in this problem in the way that I would think is at least somewhat acceptable, but I won't go into that. So there are all these issues about modeling dropout that I'm going to skip over. Quite important with these low-level cases, the issue of masking, that you often have DNA from a victim, which is at high level, and it could be masking the allele from the true perpetrator. So we need to take that into account. Drop in. I've got just some little simulation results here that show no matter how much you fiddle this 2P rule, which is part of the random man idea and always claimed to be conservative, is not. So these are probabilities under various assumptions, likelihood ratios, which are smaller than the likelihood ratio under the 2P rule. And I'll skip all of that. Oh, actually, this one is quite interesting This is about what happens if the crime scene profile is null. And if the defendant is heterozygous, I say that's slight evidence against him. The typical position of almost everyone in the field would be to say that if the crime scene profile is null and there's no evidence and we can ignore it, I say that's slightly incriminating, because if you didn't see anything, it's more likely that the offender was heterozygous, and so if your defendant is heterozygous, that's slight evidence against him. It's slight evidence in his favour if he's homozygous, but if there's masking, it can be dramatic evidence in favour of the defendant, and that's sometimes not appreciated. And I will just hesitate slightly on this case, because it's sort of remarkable. The idea is sometimes suggested that all the problems are solved in the DNA evidence field, and this is an example of what seems to me the most kind of scandalous miscarriage of justice, as I understood the case. There was a known contributor to the sample, and the case revolved around whether or not this suspected contributor was actually the true contributor. This is what was seen in the crime scene profile. You see several dashes here means nothing was observed. So both contributors were at very low levels of DNA, and we had a substantial amount of dropout. This was the sort of random man not excluded probability reported in court, total of 1 in 96,000. It seems to have been convincing enough for the guy to get convicted. But if you start looking closely at this, there's some really scandalous things going on here. Look at this 12 and 13 that was observed in the crime scene sample. It's exactly the same as the genotype of the known contributor. So arguably this is no evidence at all. It's just reflecting the known contributor. It doesn't tell us anything. But the relevant likelihood ratio used for that locus was 6.5, because that's what you get from this random man not excluded formula, which is completely illogical and completely misrepresents the evidence. And when I applied the sort of likelihood ratio-based theory that I'm talking about, so I've got some criticisms of the methods here, I could modify the random man not exclude formula to be a bit more reasonable. Instead of 96,000, I would have got 8. But when I did a likelihood ratio calculation that allows, for example, evidence to favor the defendant at some loci, where if it's less than 1, I come up, instead of 96,000, with a likelihood ratio of 2. This is, you know, virtually useless and the worst, the weakest DNA evidence I've ever come across. There's really hardly any information in it. There's only 3 alleles in all of this that are attributable to this person and not to that person. So it's really shockingly weak evidence, completely misunderstood and misrepresented in court, and the guy was found guilty. So my conclusions, as I said, I had hoped to come back to and draw more explicit parallels with voice problems, but I didn't really feel confident to do that. I want to tell you that there's a lot of progress being made with DNA evidence. Situation is much better than it used to be, but as that previous case just shows, there's a lot still wrong, and much remains unsatisfactory, and there are some fundamental problems with the logical approach to which I don't think there's ever going to be a really satisfactory solution, but it nevertheless provides the most useful framework for thinking about the problems. So I should stop there, and sorry I've gone over that. Thank you.
Thank you, David, very much for accepting to be here in Brno and for a very, very interesting talk. And I think we can spare some coffee minutes to have a discussion.
I have a question concerning our evaluations of automatic systems. Usually we select a lot of different speaker comparisons from the corpus randomly. Mm-hmm. While in forensic casework, we almost always have similar sounding speakers. So when we do our evaluations, we want to estimate our accuracy and precision. Mm-hmm. And do you think this is adequate when we have a different selection of different speaker comparisons?
Well, obviously it's difficult to get it right. I mean, it seems to me that this is you have to do some version of this calibration on the basis of known speakers. But let me see if I understood your question. I mean, the problem is about the limited selection of comparisons. Is that what you're...
Not the limitation, but the usually... The question is, should we only use different speaker comparisons in our evaluations of speakers who sound similar, because this is the case in forensic casework? No policeman comes to us with 2 totally different sounding speakers and asks us to do an expertise.
I see that. Again, the issues that I've had to worry about are quite distinct. There's some overlap, but there are fundamental differences. And that's obviously somewhat unsatisfactory, but nevertheless, I can't see that it's going to sort of bias you in a difficult, in a bad direction, because this is the most challenging situation to distinguish the similar sounding voices, and any bias inherent in that should be a good bias, I would have thought, that makes it more difficult for you to establish produce evidence for identity
But however, our estimation of our accuracy and precision is based on different comparisons,
yes,
of different speakers. So maybe we are too daring to use the results from an evaluation where we have more easier tasks to do.
Yes. But if you are trying to distinguish same source from different source, if the different sources that you use are different but similar, that makes that a harder comparison, not easier. So that's what I was suggesting, that this shouldn't be a... I mean, it's clear that you have to do something like we were like what you were doing, and it would be nice to have properly well-designed experiments where you have speakers that are similar and speakers that are more different, and you can see the range of differences. I mean, I've emphasized a lot the role of relatedness for DNA evidence, but I don't know, of relative, distinguishing brothers speaking, for example, whether that's harder than for unrelated individuals. So ideally you'd like to be able to consider all those comparisons. When you say you might be overstating the precision, but ultimately you want to assess your success in distinguishing same from different. And if you've given yourself a harder task to do by having the different speakers being somewhat similar, which I keep counting.
But actually it should be the other way around, I think. We should do harder tasks in our evaluation so we can be more sure in our forensic casework.
Yeah, okay, maybe I've missed something in the problem, because it does seem to me a harder task. If you had very different sources, you could distinguish them quite easily. And so that's an easy task. If you have similar sources, trying to distinguish them is hard. So you have given yourself a harder task, it seems to me, unless I've missed something in your problem. Anyway, maybe we can chat a bit more later and
Thank
I get
you.
To the bottom of this, but I'm not...
Hi, David. Thank you for your talk. My question tries to take advantage of your experience in court. So imagine we had a speech lab or a speech analyst that hires you to present evidence in court, and the situation would be that we have a perpetrator recording, maybe a long one, and we are able to estimate multiple likelihood ratios.
Yes.
All of them, you don't know actually if they're independent or not. You could imagine that there is quite a reasonable uncorrelation between them, but you cannot prove that they're independent. You would like to apply the probable rule, but you cannot. And those multiple likelihood ratios, all of them have small values, maybe 10, 100, some of them 1,000. The idea is how to present that evidence in court when you have multiple different pieces of evidence.
Yes.
And you cannot prove the, or at least you don't have time to prove the independence of those pieces.
Yes. Well, okay, that is an interesting and difficult question, and I feel instinctively, as I was saying earlier, that given the right framework, then some independence assumption ought to be more or less reasonable, and you can never prove independence. It does always ultimately people spend a long time trying to prove independence of different alleles in DNA profiles, and it's a futile exercise ultimately. But if dependence is a really serious problem, I'm just trying to think. I need to understand what the dependent structure is to sort of really help you. I mean, but if dependence is a real and unsurmountable problem, then I think you're stuck. Really, I really can't see how to make use of the multiple evidence, because obviously, if you did have independence, you can multiply likelihood ratios, and everything is easy. So the analogy with DNA evidence is that the relatedness is the right thing to condition on, and things become can be independent once you've got the right conditioning. But in general, this kind of model where there's some kind of latent variable, so essentially relatedness is a latent variable, and some kind of model where there is a latent variable that can encapsulate the common features of the different recordings that generates the dependence. If you can condition on that latent variable and then integrate it out in some way or deal with it in some appropriate way, I feel as if there should be some modeling approach like that that would work and allow you to then make an independence assumption. I mean, in general, modeling dependent data, these kind of random effects models type things work quite well, and I would have thought that's the avenue you have to explore to the extent where you can be reasonably confident about an independence assumption and give some good arguments for it. I mean, I've always, I can still never prove independent any of the independence assumptions I make for the DNA profiles, but I just try to argue from reason that, relatedness is the only cause, and if we model it, we should have solved the dependence problem. And I would have thought that some kind of avenue like that is the only option available. But can you tell me briefly what is the cause of the dependence that...
The dependence is quite easy. We have to can be analyzed in different fonts, syllables, and prosodic events. All of them have different characteristics, but all of them come from the same source, which is...
Once you condition on it being the same source, they... I think there's a modeling answer, but if you really can't tackle the dependence with some kind of modeling answer, then I think you do have a real fundamental problem, because ultimately you're going to say, well, if there is dependence there, then how big could it be? And if you can't really quantify that in some way, then I don't think you can usefully give multiple likelihood ratios and hope that the court will figure it out, because... I think you've got to do the work.
Thank you, David. I think people like Joaquin and I have, for rhetorical reasons, been saying we should emulate DNA.
Yes.
And you've gone through and said, oh, here are all the problems with DNA.
I think you're doing exactly the right thing. I wouldn't disagree with the strategy.
Okay, that's what I wanted to ask. From what you've observed,
yes.
Should we still be saying we should emulate DNA?
Well, I think so, yes. I mean, for all these... I mean, I have to say the difficulties remain, otherwise I'm out of a job. And they, but it is true. But we're definitely much better off than we were 10 years ago. And it's a bit like when you're teaching, almost anything. In effect, you tell the second year class, forget everything we told you last year. That was an oversimplified version of the problem. Here is the real problem. And then in the third year, you tell the students, forget everything we told you last year. That's an oversimplified version of the problem. Here is the real thing. I can't remember quite what now, but there are some things where I do actually literally tell the students that. And I think that you have to, get acceptance from the community by focusing on simplified versions. And it is a step forward. And then there will always be... you're never going to overcome all the problems, I suspect. But it's actually interesting that, these various complications that I've talked about, many of them I don't think you do have analogs for, and in many cases you're better off. I think you've suggested to me in conversation that, we have these population genetics models, and that, and particularly this thing I'm talking about, that all the dependence comes from relatedness, and once we can condition on the right level of relatedness, we can get rid of the dependence. And I agree that's a sort of good point, but there's lots of subjectiveness in those models. And we have many other problems that I was describing to you that I don't think you do have any analogy for. So in many ways, I think the grass is greener on your side of the fence. Yes.
Okay, well, I would like to thank David again. I'm pretty sure that the discussion